Hello, Mark here. Before we begin today's episode, I would just like to quickly take the time to ask all of those who are enjoying the series a favour. If the platform you use to listen to Castings for Ancient Greece has a rating or review system, I'd be extremely grateful if you would consider leaving the series a quick review. These ratings and reviews go a long way into helping others discover the show, in turn helping it grow. So if you enjoy the series and can spare a few minutes, I would love to read what you have to say about your experiences with the show. Thanks everyone for your support, and let's get to today's episode. Hello everyone, I'm Mark Selleck and welcome back to Castings for Ancient Greece for this interview episode with Professor Paul Cartledge, where we'll be discussing what made the Spartans remarkable. When discussing ancient Greece, the city of Sparta inevitably comes to mind. Alongside Athens, it held a position of great power in the Greek world, spanning from the Archaic period into the Classical Age. Across the ages, a reputation of discipline, military virtue, courage, and valour have persisted, with many attempting to emulate what they perceive as a Spartan way in their own societies, militaries, or organisations. Conversely, some have sought to criticise or diminish the significance of the ancient Spartans. Both perspectives, however, often fail to grasp the full understanding of who the Spartans were, neglecting the context of the world they inhabited. Many modern interpretations of Spartan ideals are moulded to fit particular agendas, selectively incorporating traits, while disregarding essential aspects that define the Spartans. Conversely, critiques are often rooted in a contemporary understanding, overlooking the 2,500 years of development since the Spartans' zenith. Such criticisms tend to target isolated aspects of Spartan culture, without considering the historical context, essentially judging them by the values of our present times. This recurring pattern is evident across various facets of society, making it challenging to find accounts of Sparta presented on its own terms. In my series, I have endeavoured to break away from this trend, seeking to neither idealise nor demean the Spartans, but rather comprehend who they were, their actions, and the motivations behind them. Adding to the mystery is the fact that the Spartans left no written records of their history. Our knowledge comes primarily from writers of other Greek cities, particularly Athens. When inviting Professor Cartledge to the show, it was this enigmatic nature of the Spartans that I aim to explore. Something must indeed be extraordinary and intriguing about the polis for numerous ancient writers, not of Spartan origin, to comment on various aspects related to the Spartans. My choice of Professor Cartledge as a guest stems from his position as leading historian on the Spartans, while his work, which I have admired for a long time, is characterised by an unbiased approach. He presents the Spartans without placing them on a pedestal or denigrating them. Instead, he endeavours to understand them on their own terms. Professor Paul Cartledge was educated at Oxford. He is A.G. Leventis Senior Research Fellow of Clare College, Cambridge, an Emeritus A.G. Leventis Professor of Greek Culture in the University of Cambridge, retired 2014. He is the author, co-author, editor, or co-editor of some 30 books, the most recent being Democracy, A Life, 2018, and Thebes, The Forgotten City of Ancient Greece, 2021. He is a Commander of the Order of Honour, Hellenic Republic, an honorary citizen of Spartiae, today's modern Sparta. In the upcoming episode, as the title suggests, we delve into what makes the Spartans remarkable. Professor Cartledge provides much-needed context around the Spartans and the broader Greek world. We explore various facets of Spartan life, including their values, education system, political structure, and military prowess. Additionally, we examine the role of women in Sparta, the Spartan mirage, and their lasting legacy. While these are our key points of focus, our conversation does delve into many other areas of interest. Without further ado, I present to you Professor Paul Cartledge.
Welcome, Professor Cartledge. It's fantastic to have you on the show, coming to talk to us about the Spartans.
Thank you, Mark, for having me. Really kind of you to ask me.
Yeah, I've been looking forward to this chat. I have read a number of your books over the years. I think my first introduction to Greek history was Herodotus. And I think not long after that, your book, The Spartans, and Tom Holland's Persian Fire were the first two sort of modern histories that I read after trying to digest Herodotus.
Well, you started in the right place because Herodotus, we call him the father of history. And, of course, he is, in a way, the very first Western person who wrote history in this sense, not just what happened, but why did it happen and what does it mean that it happened the way it did. So he was critical. And that's, of course, a word we in English speakers we take from the Greeks. Kritis means a judge. And history isn't just the past. We all have different pasts. We're very aware now, of course, identity politics. We choose to remember what we wish to remember. But Herodotus was the first to write about civilizations as well, not just individual people or individual cities, but whole cultures. So Greeks as against non-Greeks, especially Persians.
Yeah, so I found his work quite deep. After I usually read it probably once a year, just out of interest, and I always tend to find that there's a new question that pops up every time I read it. It's crammed full of so much.
Well, one of my favorite modern historians, 18th century, Edward Gibbon, he once said that Herodotus writes sometimes for children and sometimes for philosophers. So what he meant by that was that on the one hand, he told really nice stories. And of course, today we're much more critical. We're much more rational, perhaps, even than Herodotus. So we don't believe absolutely every story he told. But on the other hand, he sometimes imagined situations where the whole big questions about are men responsible, humans, for their actions? Or do some forces such as gods or goddesses determine what humans do? So the big philosophical issues about who we are, where we came from, why we exist at all. And then he has some lovely stories. For example, he'll make his emperor Xerxes as a character in his drama. He's invading Greece. Think forward to, oh dear, in 100 years, this is all fiction, in fact, but it's a lovely story. Herodotus makes Xerxes muse. In 100 years' time, none of the people, and he's looking at thousands, hundreds of thousands on a battlefield, will be here. And so you think mortality, legacy, you think all those sorts of big pictures. So great historian, absolutely well worth reading once a year. Well done, you.
Yes. Well, thank you. Well, I guess before we do get stuck into some stuff around the Spartans, I was wondering, obviously, I think most people in historical circles to do with ancient Greece are aware of your work and what you've done. But I thought perhaps those that are newish to ancient Greece, could you just give us a bit of your background?
Sure. Well, I'm from an upper middle class English family. I was born in London, City of London. I went privately educated at school, high school, you'd call it. And then I went to Oxford. I read there what's called Greats, which is a combination of knowing Latin and Greek, reading Latin and Greek texts. And also then, on the one hand, ancient history, that is both Greek and Roman. And on the other hand, philosophy. So my undergraduate degree was half philosophy, half history. And by that time, by the age of 22 or so, I thought, well, I've done a lot of history. I've done a lot of literature. I want to do something different. So I did an archaeological doctorate at Oxford again, but not as normal, as it were, Greek historians like myself, historians of ancient Greece. They would normally have done a historical topic, but I chose to do an archaeo-historical topic. So my main evidence was archaeological evidence. And so I had to familiarize myself with excavation reports, with field surveys, and putting together, and this is actually the main problem I'm still currently in the middle of, is putting together mute archaeological data. The spade, it said, never lies. And someone said, yes, that's because it can't speak. You have to make archaeological evidence speak. And how do you do it? Well, you use an interpretative framework, which comes ultimately from literary evidence, from written sources, whether historical accounts or whether they are epigraphical documents, that is, inscriptions. People write tombstones, for example, or sometimes laws. The Greeks inscribed some of their laws and they put them on bronze or stone. So I became what we'd now call an archaeohistorian, and that's back now in the early to mid-1970s. And by then, I'd already had two or three jobs. I actually worked for 6 years in Ireland. After my graduate work in Oxford, I taught in Northern Ireland, then I taught in Southern Ireland, and I got a job back in England in 1979. I've been in Cambridge ever since then, so the last 50, getting on for 50 plus years anyway. So I'm, yes, as you say, I'm a historian of ancient Greece. I've written or I've edited something like 30 books. I mean, it's getting on. And the ones you mention are indeed the ones, I suppose, that mean the most to me. Sparta. Why did I fix on Sparta? Because my supervisor, the man who actually mentored me during my archaeological doctoral work at Oxford, was somebody who had done some work on the excavated material from Sparta. And it was British dig material. In other words, the excavations carried out beginning of the 20th century by the British school at Athens. So he said, go out to Greece, look again at what the British dug up in the early 20th century, and then reinterpret it in light of subsequent both discoveries and interpretations. So I became an archaeohistorian of Sparta. My first book was the book of my doctoral thesis, and I took it from there. Now, I had another particular interest in doing Sparta, and it was because I was then very left-wing. And as many people, I was born in the late 40s, and so I came of age in the 60s and blah, 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 the student revolution and what have you. Well, the Spartans, though I've studied them now for 60-odd years, I don't particularly love them, if I can put it that way. They say that if you work on a subject and you want to write sympathetically about them, then you've got to in some way really like them. Well, what I don't like, I'll put it in a nutshell, their lifestyle, and it was a massively interesting and successful one, was based on, I mean, if you imagine a kind of pyramid there at the top, layers of people below them, all Greek, but who were more or less disenfranchised or exploited. And right at the bottom, the largest single population element in the entirety of the Spartan state, bunch of people the Spartans called helots. And I don't know if that word is familiar in Australian discourse, but it does actually appear in dictionaries. I mean, it means any people who are collectively exploited. I'll give you a modern example, blacks in South Africa before the end of apartheid. So under apartheid, blacks had no rights and they were treated pretty much like things, chattels, rather than human beings. Now, the oddity in ancient Greece of this was that the Greek ideal, we're going to talk more about this later, was of freedom and participation and involvement and agency. Well, the helots, though they were Greeks, they were natives, they had been conquered by the Spartans and forced to work for the Spartans so that they were the labor force of the Spartans. Some few of them did rise. I mean, there was some social mobility, but by and large, you're born a slave, you die a slave. And sometimes you rise up, hoping for your freedom, and you get knocked down again. So whenever one thinks the Spartans did this, you have to then think, yes, but they couldn't have done it but for the helots and other people. So that's why I've always felt a bit conflicted at studying the Spartans. On the one hand, admire them intensely, and we'll come back to why, but on the other hand, really feel uncomfortable about the very nature of Spartan society and politics.
Yeah. So I guess, I mean, you've sort of delved in a bit into what I was going to ask you to what initially drew you to your study of Sparta. But with having uncovered more to do with Sparta. How has this also increased your understanding of the wider Greek world as well?
Well, the thing which, of course, struck me, it grows on you as you become more experienced as an ancient historian. There are really four political entities around which one can write wider Greek history, as opposed to just the history of that city. And by the way, I should preface everything I say by pointing out that there were 1,000 separate Greek political entities. And it's quite remarkable, as we say, the ancient Greeks. Well, there were 1,000 different lots of ancient Greeks, and they were scattered all around the Mediterranean and around the Black Sea. So of those 1,000, there were four political entities which were such that you could write a wider Greek history around them: Sparta, Athens, and then thirdly, one I wrote my most recent book on, actually, Thebes, and it very much, very brief, the Theban dominance, the Theban prominence came late in ancient Greek history and didn't last for very long. Athens and Sparta were, as it were, number one, number two. If you can imagine for example, English Premiership soccer football terms, it's Arsenal or Manchester City for hundreds of years. And then Thebes, I mentioned, we can come back or we can leave Thebes, but they are in central Greece, Athens and Thebes, whereas Sparta's in southern Greece. Well, then the last of the four great powers was from northern Greece, from Macedonia. And of course, that's been very controversial politically recently for all sorts of difficult reasons. But in ancient Greece, Macedonia, up in the north, north of the mainland Greek peninsula, had been nothing really, just a collection of people, until about 400 BC, one king of the Macedonians united the kingdom, and they started to make some sort of a name for themselves further south. But it was with the reigns of Philip II and his son Alexander, who becomes Alexander the Great, Macedon actually becomes the great power of old Greece. So they conquer mainland Greece. They are the place from which, after Alexander conquers most of the Middle East, the Greek world of the next 300 years, in the last three centuries BC, is a Macedonian-dominated Greek world. So Sparta is the first major Greek power. Athens rises up in the 5th century. Thebes, briefly, in the 4th century. Macedon from the 4th century onwards, until the Romans conquer Greece in the 2nd and 1st centuries BC. So I found myself, and this is partly purely coincidental. I mean, when I'd done my undergraduate studies, I'd of course written about Sparta because Sparta was such a big deal in the early part of Greek history in the 7th, 6th centuries. But I hadn't quite realized that by doing a doctorate on Sparta, I was going to be in the position to, well, I won't put it too strongly, dominate the field or sort of create an entire field. But if I put it this way, most historians of ancient Greece, like me, studying 8th, 7th, 6th, 5th, 4th, would gravitate towards Athens and Athens's influence. Not surprisingly, most of the evidence for ancient Greek history comes from either Athenians or, we've talked about Herodotus, people who were very influenced by, who went to Athens, were influenced by Athenian outlooks and wrote history around Athens, not around Sparta, because Sparta, either famously or notoriously, was not very cultured. So in other words, writing literature, producing written accounts of, that's not a Spartan thing. They did rather than thought, if I can put it that way. So you're in this ironic situation where you're writing history of Sparta, but looking at Sparta through Athenian or Athenian-influenced eyes, with one exception, and this is where I've tried to make a virtue of it. Archaeological evidence is, as I've said, mute. In itself, it doesn't speak, but it's authentic. It's genuine. It's not, if you like, got an axe to grind. And so you excavate Sparta, and you're excavating authentic Spartan life. You're as close to a real ancient Spartan as you'll ever get, because you're looking at stuff which was actually once held by a Spartan or made by somebody in Sparta. You see how exciting it was to me to get into a new way of looking at ancient Sparta.
Yeah, I was gonna ask you, given the fact that I guess our sources coming out of Sparta are very almost non-existent if we're talking about writers, and you've alluded to that obviously archaeology is one avenue that helps shed some light on Spartan history. What other sources or mythologies have you used to help reconstruct your histories around Sparta?
Well, you used the word mythologies there, and of course there are two, in a way, types of ways of thinking about ancient Greece, especially early Greece. So what is the earliest Greek literature? Homer, Iliad, Odyssey. Now, as a historian, what you ask is, how historically based is the siege and the capture, the fall of Troy, for example? Well, if you're a Spartan historian, that has an absolutely central relationship and relevance for you, because Helen of Troy was originally Helen of Sparta. She was nicked by Paris, the Trojan prince, from Sparta to go to Troy, which is, well, we can argue exactly what Troy was at the time, but it's pretty clear that there's one site in northwest Turkey which is the most likely real basis of Homer's mythical account of the Trojan War story. So Sparta exists as the capital of Menelaus's kingdom, and Helen is his wife. Now, was there a real ancient Sparta of the right sort of period to be Menelaus's capital? The answer only very recently has been discovered. This is quite extraordinary. We knew where Mycenae was, the kingdom of Agamemnon, for 140 years, but we didn't know where Sparta in, you know, the original Homeric Sparta was until very recently, and it's actually quite a long way south of today's Sparta. So there is a disconnect. There is terrific centrality of the importance of Sparta in the earliest Greek literature. But the ancient equivalent, the real Sparta of that period, and we call it the Late Bronze Age, the Late Mycenaean Age, or Helladic Age. There are various archaeological terms for that period before historical Sparta. There is a big disconnect between the Bronze Age Sparta, the Sparta that's the basis of the myth, and the real Sparta, which is pretty much where modern town of Sparta is. It was plonked, modern Sparta, 1834, after the independence from the Turks. A new Sparta was built bang on top of where the ancient historical Sparta was. So the Sparta I study comes into being in the 9th, 8th centuries BC, in the 800s, the 700s. But there is a word which I think is very helpful for getting a handle on how is the source picture for the ancient Spartans. When you want to try to get a hold on what the real ancient Spartans were like, what they did, what's the evidence? Well, you ask me. There is this word, mirage. That was coined in the 1930s by a French scholar. And his point was this: we don't very often, in fact, hardly ever, get direct access from a Spartan source that's contemporary, authentic, and not wildly biased for hundreds of years of historical Spartan history. So Sparta comes into being, and it's not until 500 years later that an actual Spartan sets about writing about his own community. So before that, you are reliant on non-Spartan sources, and they can be divided basically crudely into two categories. One, those who thought ancient Sparta was really great, and they were non-Spartans, and they're writing about Sparta. They wish their city was more like Sparta, or exactly like what they think Sparta is like. On the other side, you've got those who hated the Spartans, and maybe just for political reasons, in other words, the Spartans had done something to them, or they hated the way of life of the Spartans. And it might be a kind of a liberal attitude. They thought that the treatment of the helots by the Spartans was atrocious. Or it might be, you know, not quite so high-minded. It might simply be that they didn't wish for themselves to have to go through a Spartan educational regime or live, in effect, in barracks like the Spartan warriors seem to have had to do. So, the mirage metaphor works in this way, I think. You and I, if we're driving, let's say, in a very dusty area, straight road, very hot, and you see on the road in front of you what looks like a pool of water. Well, there isn't really a pool of water. That's a mirage. So the Spartan mirage is partly like that. It's people saying things about Sparta that really aren't true. They really weren't there. Now, there's another version of mirage, which is, and I use the analogy of a stick, straight stick, in a jug of water. If you put a straight stick in a jug and look at it, it looks bent, looks crooked. Well, so that's like somebody non-Spartan looking at Sparta and seeing things that are there. Really, there is a stick, but they see it crookedly. They reflect it inaccurately. So the mirage is a combination of pure invention and of distorted reflection. Now, how then do you sort out those two, first of all? And then secondly, thirdly, well, and rather what I want to get to is the actuality. So the straight stick in the water, the jug of water, the non-pool of water on the road. So I've spent my life, and historians will always differ because there is no such objective standard. There is no... as it were, well, history anyway is always partly invention, but in the case of Sparta, it's much more invention, inevitably, than it is in the case of some other cities, because the Spartans themselves don't give us enough authentic evidence of their own for us to work with.
So I guess the mirage, it could be putting Sparta on a pedestal, or it could be someone who's looking to bash Sparta. It doesn't matter which sort of end of the spectrum they're on.
Completely right.
Yeah. All right. Well,
I'll give you one example just before we move on. Yeah. An example of somebody who sets Sparta up on a pedestal is the Athenian Xenophon. Now, he's a most interesting character, flourishing around 400 BC, very elite, very wealthy and well-born and what have you, very conservative, so not keen on the regime in force in his own city, which was democracy. And democracy implies that the masses, the demos, the people as a whole, ordinary people, have ultimate power and control. Now, if you're from one of the elite, that is the few, the better educated, the wealthier, your feelings towards democracy are that it's not your system, because it's not a system geared to favor you. You can flourish in it, but you have to accept that the masses are going to have to be humored. You're going to have to somehow win them round. Well, Xenophon was one who didn't like the system, like Plato, another contemporary of his, another philosopher. And they both looked to Sparta because it seemed to them a nice hierarchical, in a military sort of way, top down. So ordinary Spartans, by and large, this is their view, obeyed. They respected their betters, who are the officers, as it were, at the top, including, of course, some who are just born superior. And we'll come back to the two kings, for example. And so Sparta seemed to them a hierarchical, orderly society without a masses who are constantly making things difficult for the elite.
Hmm. All right. Well, I thought, obviously, I'm calling this episode Sparta, a Remarkable Polis, and we're going to drill down into some aspects of what made Sparta remarkable. But I thought before we do, it might be helpful just to get some context. I mean, you started just pointing out a historical Sparta developing around the 900s BC. So perhaps could we just explain or just a bit of a summary of how Sparta would emerge within Greece?
Right. So that date is, of course, archaeological. There is no writing in Greece anywhere at that period. And this is one of the peculiarities of ancient Greek history, that they had writing in the Bronze Age, the so-called Linear B script, but it wasn't an alphabetic script, it was a syllabary, so each sign stands for a syllable, not for a single letter or single sound. And for some 300 to 400 years, that script disappeared, Linear B. And there was nothing until round about 800, and this is just when we're talking about Sparta coming into existence as a settlement. Someone somewhere invented an alphabet, which was translated into Greek terms. It was borrowed from a neighboring people. We call them, or the Greeks called them, the Phoenicians. They lived in what's today Lebanon. Anyway, Sparta emerges as a very strung out series of villages rather than a compact settlement with a wall around it. Some Greek cities as early as the 9th, 8th centuries had walls around them. Well, the Spartans never did at the time of their great period. Later in their history, Roman conquest and so on, yes, they got a wall, but that's when Sparta was no longer a major player. So why and how Sparta emerges, the ancient written sources tell us, and this is part myth, that a bunch of people came down from North Greece, from a region called Doris, which is up in the north and eastern part of the Greek peninsula, towards the Macedonia I was talking about. And so they migrated. This is a period in which, indeed, there was a lot of Greek movement going east to what's today Turkey, going west to France, Spain, North Africa, and so on. So it wouldn't have been odd if really there had been Greeks wandering around, coming from the north and coming to settle down in Sparta. But some of us think, no, that's probably largely myth, and it doesn't have much of a historical basis. But at any rate, whatever the actual explanation of how Sparta came to be, round about 800 BC, a settlement in the plain of the river Eurotas. Now, this is the absolutely key geographical feature, together with the two mountain chains on either side of the Eurotas Valley. So it's exceptionally fertile and it's exceptionally defensible, the settlement site of Sparta in the south Peloponnese, southeast Peloponnese of mainland Greece. And it rattles along and never develops much in the way of urban infrastructure and doesn't seem ever to have been particularly densely settled. The total population could have got up into the tens of thousands, but nevertheless, compared with Athens, which is going to be a big city with a city wall and an acropolis in the middle, Sparta has a relatively paltry acropolis, no city wall, and settlements are strung out along quite a long area in this part of the Eurotas Valley, the northern Eurotas Valley. Now, the main differentiating factor, why does Sparta ever become the biggest thing in Greece, as it has done by 500 BC? In one word, the conquest of Messenia. Now, I've mentioned the Helots to you before. That's a collective term for all the Greeks that the Spartans treated as if they had all been conquered And it's true, I think, that at least half of them were conquered, but it's not necessarily the case they all resisted a major military enterprise by the Spartans. It's very complicated to try to understand how the Spartans developed their helot system. But there is one consistent feature of both the evidence and likelihood. Sparta is next to massive mountain chain. I've mentioned there were two mountain chains. Well, the one on the west is called the Taygetos mountain chain. It rises to what we would call 8,000 feet, 2,400 meters. You can't just walk through it or across it with an army. And yet, if you look on a map, Sparta's territory, its city-state territory, is almost half the Peloponnese. If you drew a line north of Sparta, across the Peloponnese, well, everything south of that, the Spartans controlled, owned, exploited. So half of it had to be conquered physically by armies going round Taygetos, not over Taygetos. And imagine, once you've defeated the local people there, you've enslaved them, you've set in place a situation which keeps them down, and that's complicated in itself. You've got then to go back to Sparta. How do you keep track? How do you manage to maintain the system? Well, the way you do it is you find people who are not the helots. They're free, but they're not Spartans. So they're local village communities who are left free, but their function is partly to watch out for any Messenian helot unrest. And the Spartans called people like that, and they had them in their own territory, by the way, their own original southeast Peloponnesian territory too, and they're called perioikoi, they're called dwellers roundabout. So not Spartans, not helots, but somewhere in between. And that's the point I was making earlier about the pyramid, the layering of Spartan society, from the Spartans at the very top, helots at the bottom, in between are these perioikoi. So by, let's say, 700 BC, Sparta has this enlarged, hugely enlarged territory. They had to fight for it. It seems that the Messenians, some of them, always resented being subjects of Sparta, and periodically they'd rise up, sometimes with help from other Greeks outside the Spartans' territory. And there was a big, apparently, rebellion in the 7th century, so in the 600s. But by 600 BC, you can say the Spartan territory is fixed. They are, therefore, by far the biggest city-state in the entire Greek world, huge territory, about 8,000 square kilometers, 3,000 square miles, two riverine valleys, very fertile. So olives, wheat, barley, all growing very, very well. Wine, therefore, they were never short of. Grain, cereals, they were never short of. And therefore, it's fundamentally a combination of power, military power, and economic resources, which put Sparta in number one spot. But, well, we'll come back. Maybe you want me to come back later to political developments. But the military developments are the crucial basis of the emergence of Sparta as, well, we call it a conquest state. I think that's a very good description of it.
Mm. And I think what I found reading Spartan history is you start to see that they have a very different value system to other areas of Greece. Could you maybe just sort of point out where they differ to a lot of other Greek city-states?
Right. Well, now this where, as I don't want to labor this, but I would preface, or that your listeners must imagine before I answer any question, the mirage. So the answer one gives to any such question has to be conditioned by the fact that there is an element of myth-making, an inevitable element on both sides in regard to such a question as you've just asked me, the fundamental values. So the pro-Spartan side emphasizes the military-ness of Spartan society. So an educational system which for the boys is designed to produce not thinkers, but doers, and in particular, warriors, and particular warriors of a certain kind. So the way in which Greeks fought, developing in the 7th and 6th century, is a very particular form of phalanx, that is heavy and closely packed infantry warfare, based on one item of defensive equipment, namely the shield, basically made of wood, but with bronze facing. It's about a meter wide. It's heavy. And in order to be functional, you have to have someone next to you on your right, who's protecting your right side. You're protecting your left side, but you need your right side protected in close formation. So we call those people, this is an ancient Greek word, hoplites. Mm-hmm. So the Spartans became the best at in all Greece, but they, of course, initially fought only in the Peloponnese. Later, they then fought in the central Greece against Athens and later against Thebes and so on. But initially, all their fighting is against other Peloponnesian cities. They became the greatest hoplite military state. Now, some scholars today, taking account of the mirage, they say, yes, okay, they were very good at fighting. And yes, they obviously had a really good army. But that wasn't the be-all and end-all. And they tried desperately to make Sparta less military than the other side wants to make them. But I'm old-fashioned, I suppose, but I think they were predominantly a military state. So far as the men are concerned, so what were their values? I think they can be put down as discipline, obedience, and above all, bravery. Now, there is a Greek word. It's the standard word for the virtue of courage. But literally, it means manliness or virility. And that tells you quite a lot, because it means that women, half the human race, in ancient Greek value terms, cannot be brave because they're not male. And that tells you, as I say, quite a lot. We'll come back to the women of Sparta later. So the notion is the educational system teaches endurance, tolerance of great deprivation and pain. So you've got to be able to keep going on the minimum of food. You've got to have a body that can tolerate the maximum of heat, the uncomfortableness of running over rocks. Greece is very, very rocky. And doing with as little sleep as possible, being able to function in the dark, not only in the light. You can see what I mean. These are all soldierly virtues. But today, we associate them only with elite forces, such as the Marines or the paratroops, not a regular infantrymen. Spartans were trained to be elite force soldiers of the most extreme kind. Now, what about non-martial, i.e. quiet virtues of just when they're not actually fighting? And of course, they didn't fight all that much. They trained a great deal, but they didn't fight all that much. And ideally, they would rather not fight. It's very interesting that number of times we learn that where there could have been an actual encounter, the Spartans were happy if they deterred their enemies from taking them on or gave up a position simply from the threat of a Spartan attack upon them. And that's a very sensible thing, because you minimize loss of manpower. But they did all sorts of things like minimize the individual quality. So the chief qualities are cooperative, not individual. For example, the only case in which a Spartan could have a name on his grave, and this is absolutely extraordinary, every other Greek city, when you die, and they're very familiar with the notion of a tombstone, and you put the name of the person on the tombstone. Spartans allowed named tombstones only for men who died in battle, not died by any other means. So that's again to highlight the absolute crucial importance of being wonderfully solidary in warfare. So what did the Spartans spend the rest of the day, as it were, or the rest of the year, when they weren't actually fighting? What were they doing? And that's, in a way, a problem. It's hard to think. They just simply existed. They didn't do any work. The Helots did all the physical work. They grew the vines, they grew the olives, they harvested the vines, the olives, they grew the wheat and barley, and so on. So a Spartan man's only work was war. And if he wasn't actually fighting, well, he was just preparing to fight. Well, what they did in the way of maintaining solidarity in the very long periods when they weren't actually fighting was they regularly had to dine together in the evening meal, which would be, I suppose, 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock in our terms in the evening. And so once a day, they would all re-solidify themselves as a community. What were their wives doing? Well, their wives were living in their homes and they were eating in their homes, because there's a total separation in lifestyle between males and females. From the age of 7, by the way, boys educated in one way, girls educated in another way. And this corresponds to the division of function between males and females. Males keep the society going by defending it or attacking other people. Women keep the society going by reproducing and managing the households of the husband and wife pairings.
Hi there. Are you after more Casting Through Ancient Greece episodes and would like to support the show? Well, I have some good news for you. Over on Patreon, a new bonus episode is released every month, where we look in more detail over topics that we have covered in the series so far. In this bonus series, we travel back to the earliest times of Greek history, where we then move forward, picking out interesting themes and topics to delve deeper into. This is also an opportunity for supporters to help drive what we cover in these bonus episodes. We have just wrapped up a series of episodes looking at different elements around the Ionian Revolt. Now we are heading into the phase of the Greek and Persian War, where we'll have many new angles to view this conflict from. So, if you have been enjoying the series, would like to support the show and gain access to ad-free, early access episodes, plus bonus episodes, please consider heading over to the Casting Through Ancient Greece Patreon page and supporting the show. Let's now get back to the episode.
Yeah, so I guess we see these instilling of these martial values starting from 7 years of age, and they're constantly reinforced all through their childhood and into adulthood. And that's what seems to, I guess, become the central point of the value system, is even though you're not going to war all the time, it's important to keep these ideas instilled so that when war does come, you are ready and your society can deal with it.
Now, I've talked about, as it were, everyday life. But there is one dimension of Spartans' lives, which is not unique. This is by no means in itself unique, but the Spartans were, the ancients said this, Herodotus said it twice, exceptionally pious. In other words, they worried more than other Greeks, and this is saying something collectively about what the gods wanted of them, what they thought they should do to keep the gods happy. And the gods means typically Apollo and Athena and Zeus. They seem to be the three major gods of the Olympian pantheon. Also Artemis, for various cultural reasons. But one thing that archaeologists have found is the extraordinarily large number of shrines. So places where religious worship went on in the settlement area of Sparta. This is very, very interesting. And that would be one thing that when you're not fighting or feasting or making love, you could privately, that is individually, pay your respects to one or other god, goddess, or hero. Spartans very keen on people who were either once upon a time human, and then they were made into divine phenomena, or they were half divine, half human in their birth. This is myth, of course, rather than reality. So their principal hero for the whole city was Heracles. And Heracles was, on the one hand, son of Zeus, but on the other hand, his mother was not a not a god. She was a human being from Thebes. So they worshipped Heracles. The leading families of the Spartans claimed that they were literally descended from Heracles, ultimately through a bunch of these Heraclids, as they're called, Heraclidae, descendants of Heracles, who'd been among the founders of the city of Sparta. They were founder leaders. And for example, the two royal families were both kingly families that claimed to be Heraclid, so that they traced their ancestry, ultimately, fictitiously, back to Heracles.
Well, I guess we've touched on how important the military was to Sparta, and you've gone a little bit into, I guess, explaining what a hoplite is in general terms. Did Sparta have any specialized training or strategies that set them apart from other Greek city-states?
We have to infer that they must have done, partly because they had so much time, partly because they had real incentives to train and be, as it were, match fit at any moment. And there is, in fact, a Greek word. The Spartans seem to have had a special word for when they're at war. And we were talking earlier about the sad situation of Israel today. Well, when the Prime Minister of Israel declares, "We are at war with Hamas," the Spartans had a word which said, "We are under military discipline. We are at war with whoever it might be." But in a sense, they were always at war, because the Helots were, the very name means captives, the sort of people that you've beaten in war and taken prisoner. So they are, as it were, prisoners of war for life. That's what the word Helot means. And the Spartans, therefore, had very, very strong mechanisms. So they had a military structure top down. There were file leaders, there were regiment leaders, there were all sorts of things. We're not sure exactly how someone became a regimental commander as opposed to a ranker, an ordinary member of the rank. How was it decided that someone fought in the front rank as opposed to one of the seven ranks behind? Typically, they would line up in eight ranks deep, depending on how many were sent out for any particular time. They organized their army in terms of age groups. So there's the 20-year-olds, the 30-year-olds, the 40-year-olds, 50-year-olds, and everybody, all Spartans, were under discipline. They were, in other words, liable for call-up up to the age of 60. You didn't become time expired and cashiered until you were 60, which is a figure which applies, of course, to another very key feature of Spartan politics and economy and society, namely the gerousia, the old men's council, which we'll come back to later. But we don't actually know, because we don't have any Spartan sources, nor do we have any ancient non-Spartan sources that in any detail talk about Spartan maneuvers or training maneuvers to enable them to reach this level of fitness and preparedness.
Well, I guess if we're going to talk about Sparta and the military and how they fought, of course, we've got to bring up Thermopylae, don't we?
We do, of course. But one must immediately say two things. First, myth. We actually have a near contemporary, because Herodotus was not a contemporary, but he was able to talk to anybody who had been involved in any way in that period, 480 BC. And of course, he'd visited Sparta and talked to Spartans whose fathers fought at Thermopylae or whatever. But there's a great deal of myth made of that, because it's actually a defeat. It sometimes has to be spelled out that it was not a victory. It wasn't one of those, it wasn't, as it were, Trafalgar for the British or whatever the Australian equivalent would be of a great victory in battle. It was a defeat. But it was a heroic defeat, and it set the tone for what was to follow after that, because had the Spartans not resisted at all, had they not led the resistance to the huge Persian invasion, of 480, perhaps 200,000 minimum, maybe even up to 1 million on the Persian side. As against the Greeks, the maximum they could muster would be getting on for 100,000 at any one time, which they do seem to have once managed to do. There's a huge disparity between the two sides. There was a risk, and of course it happened in the way it did, that the Persians would simply steamroller down. Their main target was Athens, and that was what, in fact, they got through to. So the function of Thermopylae was to hold up the Persian advance as long as it could be held up, to inflict significant damage on the Persian side so that they would realize what they were up against, and not least to coordinate between the land forces and the naval forces, which were stationed at the top of the island of Euboea within quite easy reach of Thermopylae. They were resisting the Persians by land and sea. So in all those ways, Thermopylae worked very well, and on the other hand, unfortunately, A, it was a defeat. B, it was a defeat enabled by a gross act of treachery. Now, that's not great if you're trying to resist, and relatively few Greeks actually did resist. It's often forgotten that most Greeks were either on the Persian side in mainland Greece, not necessarily because they wanted to be, but they were, or they were trying to be neutral rather than joining the relatively few Greeks who were brave enough, determined enough to physically resist, led by the Spartans. So had the Spartans not taken that leading role, no resistance before the Persians took Athens, and that really would have been almost game over, I think. But at any rate, they did put up a terrific resistance, and that gave them the authority for any future attempt to recoup, because, as I say, the Persians occupied all of Greece down to the isthmus, the division between the Peloponnese and the rest of Greece to the north, in 480 BC. So it was 479 BC, the Battle of Plataea, that was actually the determining victory of the united Greeks, which were, again, led by the Spartans. And it was a heavy infantry battle on land, led by the Spartans, who were in their element. This is in central Greece, actually in an area not far from Thebes that I mentioned earlier.
And touching just back on, I guess, military Spartan military tactics, I remember, this is just going off the top of my head, but one of the days at Thermopylae, I think Herodotus describes the Spartans withdrawing, like feigning a retreat, turning around, and then capturing the enemy off guard. And I think perhaps you can see some elements of that as well taking place at Plataea, where the Spartans were the ones who seemed to have this more controlled withdrawal back to a defensive line as opposed to the other Greeks. And maybe that sort of points to maybe some evidence that they did have some sort of superior training behind them.
Yeah, you asked me before, what evidence do we have for the types of training that they went through? We have absolutely none as such. But you can infer from what Herodotus says about that encounter in the pass. It's a very narrow pass. It's about a kilometer wide, east to west. But in places, it's only just wide enough for two chariots to pass each other. And it's right by the sea. You have to think of all that. At any rate, it does suggest, I mean, it's inevitable, I think, we have to infer that that was one maneuver that the Spartans regularly trained. Okay, one lot of Spartans would face off against another in training, and one side would pretend to flee, and then they would train. How do you turn around? You've got a spear about 9 foot long, remember, made of Cornell wood, probably. You mustn't spear your next door neighbor with that as you turn round. There are all sorts of things. Then you've got to learn to run with a shield, because actually it's so heavy you don't want to run very far. Well, in the pass, they'd only have to run maybe 100 meters or so maximum. Even that's a hell of a long way with a really heavy shield. So yes, so that would be a maneuver which they would practice. The other thing is the Battle of Thermopylae took place at the hottest point in the year. So we're in August. So we're in 40 degrees. It might not have been quite 40 then, but it would have been in the 30s at any rate. So the Spartans would train in full armor. Actually, Sparta is the hottest place in all of mainland Greece for its height above sea level, 200 meters or so above sea level, incredibly hot. So they train to learn not to be knocked out by the heat, wearing this heavy armor and running with a heavy shield so that they could whip round and inflict great damage. The Persian forces famously were more light armed than were the Greeks. And Herodotus makes that point. One reason why in Battle of Plataea, the Spartans and the other Greeks won, was that the equipment was unequal between the two sides. The Spartans had the Persian side, which was, by the way, a multi-ethnic group. There were lots of different peoples from what's today Asia, Asia Minor, Middle East. They had lighter shields, lighter spears, and they relied much more on archery, so fighting at a distance, than hand-to-hand. They weren't used to the sort of hand-to-hand mode that the Spartans and other Greeks had practiced most particularly.
Mm. Out of a point of interest, I'm assuming you've seen the movie 300. what was your opinion on...
Well, what I had against it wasn't so much, because it's done in a particular mode, you know, it's a blue screen, it's not really on a battlefield. Contrast the what was called the 300 Spartans of 1962, which is actually filmed precisely where the battle had happened in 480 BC using the Greek army and so on, so thousands of people. And the 300 movie is all CGI, computer generated. Imagery, apart from one scene, which is where a horse was involved. You can't actually film a horse galloping through a studio, so that's shot outside, but otherwise everything is faked. And so even the blood, you know, it's all laid on. The very interesting, if you've ever watched the director's cut, you can listen to Zack Snyder, and he's mainly interested in the technicalities, not in the historicity or the dramatic thing. And I hated its if you like, ideology. And that's what the Iranians got particularly upset about, presenting the Persian side as if they were some kind of animals. And historically, it's quite false insofar as it suggests that a queen of Sparta could address the Spartan assembly. Absolutely impossible. Yeah. Nevertheless, we can come back to Queen Gorgo, which means Gorgon, by the way. It's an extraordinary name to give a woman. It tells you something about the Spartans, that they would call a woman a Gorgon, which is a monster, terrifying, you know, superhuman person, not a real woman. Greek women were supposed not to be quite so mannish and violent and what have you, typically. At any rate, so I didn't like the movie. Glorified warfare. It dissed foreigners, especially Persians, as if they were sort of animals. And it was brilliantly shot in the sense of technically it was excellent. And it appealed particularly to Marines in the American army. I got quite a bit of correspondence because I'd been one of the consultants in a very, very minor way about how to pronounce various names. And I'd got various correspondence. Could you send me a copy of your book? And so on and so on. But no, I didn't. I don't think it did the cause of Greek-Persian relations or ancient history particularly well.
Yeah, I actually did probably about 2 years ago now, I did an episode on the podcast where I looked at 300, but it wasn't to look at it from, I guess, a historical perspective as such. It was more, I titled it 300 versus the sources. So I wanted to look at 300, the movie, and look at if there's points in the sources that they're drawing upon, which surprisingly I found there was quite a lot, whether it be some literally, but some figuratively as well. And I understand, like, obviously there was the big part of is glorifying war and portraying Greek history in not a helpful way when if you're trying to tell it for history's sake. But I did find, I guess, the whole premise of the movie was coming from this is a Spartan telling other Spartans what took place at Thermopylae, which I think it that gets overlooked a lot too when people do view the movie from if they do have a background in Greek history as well. But
well, I'll pull out two things. I agree with what you've just said there, that that's a very productive way of looking at the battle. And I'll just pull out a couple of things. Why 300? Why did Leonidas take 300? Well, his bodyguard, his royal bodyguard, which he regularly had, and it was recruited on an annual basis because people would get too old for it because they had to be in their 20s, was competitive. So you would look to see how different Spartans performed at different points in their education, coming up to the age of 20 when they became fully adult Spartans, and then you'd see, well, which one runs fastest, which one is strongest in wrestling, you know, all those things. So you have 300 elite royal bodyguard. Did he take the elite royal bodyguard to Thermopylae? He did not. Why did he not? This is where Herodotus, being a historian, is able to pitch in. He chose, Herodotus says, men who, of course, were brave. They had to be good fighters. You're no good taking weaklings up there, if there were any in Sparta. But they all had to be married and to have already produced, their wife having already produced a son. So you ask yourself, what's the point of that? Well, it seems to me, if you like, blindingly obvious, that the dad is very likely to get killed. If not almost certainly going to get killed, but his family line will continue. So he will be replaced. It'll take time, 20 years, but he will have a son back in Sparta. Secondly, that son will be the son of a hero who died, this is the way you should die as a Spartan, in battle. And you get a named tombstone. I talked about that earlier. And so you develop within the Spartan society an esprit de corps based on this iconic, this monumental battle. Of course, Leonidas couldn't know that when he had been killed, as he was, and the 300, most of them, I'll come back to that, had been killed, that they would then, the Greeks, go on to win. He couldn't be sure that they would win the war, but and he was, I think, pretty clear they'd probably lose the battle. Now, the other point Herodotus makes, which is often overlooked, it's often assumed Leonidas takes 300 and they all die. So all 301 of them. No, Herodotus is absolutely clear. Of course, he makes a big thing about one of them. Two of the 300 survived for different reasons. One was at the moment of the final battle, not actually on the battlefield. He'd been sent off on a mission and unable to get back in time. The other one who didn't die at Thermopylae was there at Thermopylae, but he, it's very puzzling, actually. He said, I can't see. So there's absolutely no point in my actually going and fighting. Now, I have sort of odd thoughts about this. How was he allowed not to go into the final fighting simply because he couldn't see? He had a terribly bad eye infection. Whatever. He went back to Sparta. The guy who had been sent on a mission and survived hanged himself. On going back to Sparta, he was made to feel such a heel for not having died. He felt such shame, he committed suicide. Why did the other guy, the one with the eye disease, who somehow managed to bunk off, go back to Sparta, not commit suicide? Well, Herodotus tells us he suffered the ultimate humiliation. No one would talk to him. The way he puts it is share a fire with him. So, you know, over a household inside when they're having an evening meal and they've got a fire going, no one would invite him into their house, and no one would affiance their son or daughter to any children of that guy. He obviously had one or more, either a son and a whatever, we don't know. But that, in other words, they cut him off from normal Spartan social relations then in 480 and going forward for the foreseeable future. What does he do? How does he respond? Somehow or other, he trains hard. He's amazing, you know, making up for his dereliction at Thermopylae. They go off to the battlefield at Plataea, summer 1 year later, 479. He's somehow in the front rank. Well, that tells you something. How he got back up to there to be allowed to be in the front rank. That's very interesting. He then, when the battle is joined, as you know, normally Spartans march into the actual encounter with the enemy quite slowly. And they don't rush because they have to keep cohesion over potentially uneven ground. This guy rushes out ahead. He takes out as many of the immediately facing him enemy as he can. And then, of course, he's killed because he's isolated on his own. But for him, clearly, he's, as it were, atoned for his sin at Thermopylae the year before. Herodotus thought that this guy, his name is Aristodamus, was very brave and he deserved the prize for bravery because to rush out and take on the enemy on the, the Spartans thought he was mad because that's a sign of madness if you do that. You don't wait in your rank. And they didn't award him a prize at all. And Herodotus names the Spartans who died at Plataea, and were awarded the prizes of victory, and none of them is this guy. So, but for Herodotus, most people would have thought all 300 had died at Thermopylae. No. But for Herodotus, most people would have thought, oh, Leonidas took the royal bodyguard to Thermopylae. No, he didn't. He had a pickup force of specially chosen men who were married with sons. That's history for you, not myth.
Yes. Well, I'm pretty sure we could talk about military matters to do with Sparta for our whole time together. But I think while we've still got some time together, I want to touch on some other areas too. And you've touched on Spartan women a couple of times, just briefly. They had a very unique status within Sparta compared to other city-states. How did this look?
This is an absolute classic case of the mirage that since it's largely Athens-oriented, in Athens, girls could never become full equal citizens with the boys, with their menfolk. When they were married, the relationship between wife and husband was that of guardian and ward. So there was no equality of legal status between men and women, adult men and women in Athens, excuse me. So if you take that, the Athenian situation as being far closer to the Greek norm, the Hellenic norm, all the 1,000 Greeks, most women were in the status of Athenian women. And then you consider Sparta, where women, first of all, they're educated, not just, in other words, taught skills that typically women had to perform, namely weaving, cooking, household management. The women of Sparta didn't have to learn those because Helot women performed those functions for them. So what did they do? Well, while their brothers were being educated in, sometimes it's called boarding schools or sometimes barracks, very separate buildings from their home from the age of seven. Girls lived at home till they were married, and then they went to live in the home of their husband. But while they were living at home, their mothers seem to have encouraged them, and the city seems to have encouraged them, to develop their physical strength, so their athletic capacities, their ability to run, their ability to throw. They even allegedly wrestled. And, well, this is where mirage, I think, comes in. women wrestling. Oh, they must have wrestled naked with the boys, mustn't they? Well, I think probably not, if you see what I mean. But the fact is that Spartan girls, and therefore coming up to being brides, were physically much tougher. They'd been given more food relatively than the rations given to girls in other Greek cities. All these reasons meant that physically women and men were closer together in Sparta than they were in other Greek cities. Another major, and this is a legal point, in most Greek cities women could not own land, that is the basis of economic existence and power, in their own right. So in other words, they needed a male sponsor or guardian, typically their husband, to negotiate on their behalf, to interact with, for example, if they wanted to sell land, it wouldn't be the woman who sold it, it would be the husband who, and so on. In Sparta, women could own property, land included, in their own right. Now, why? That's another question, but nevertheless, it's the fact. So in various ways, ancient Spartan women were much more like and equivalently empowered to their male counterparts, their husbands, their brothers, and so on, than was the case in, above all, as far as evidence goes, Athens. We know most about the legal status of women in Athens because we know most about social life in Athens, period. So that's part of it. But since they, now this is where Spartans, like every other Greek city, Spartan women no more fought in battle than did any other Greek women. So what was their function in a fundamentally military society and state? It was to instill, to reinforce the martial values we talked about earlier. Now, there's a whole bunch of evidence, a rather peculiar sort of evidence, and it's called apophthegms, or pithy sayings, attributed to Spartans, kings, generals, men, women. And the very fact that women are accredited with, are attributed with sayings, tells you something about the prominence, the political significance of women in Sparta. And there's a famous one, which goes in Greek, it's just a few words, but I'll spell it out in English. Come back from battle, the mother says to her son, either with it or on it. And what it is the shield. So either you come back dead and your comrades bear you, they carry you from the battlefield on a shield, or you survive, you win, and you come back with your shield and ready to fight again another day. That's just one example of how, I think they're made up, you say, but other Greeks thought Spartan women were exceptionally prominent and relatively equal to their menfolk in ways that I agree that they really probably were. And then right at the very top, there are, of course, quite exceptional women. One of them features in the 300 movie, Thermopylae, and this is Queen Gorgo, who was married to Leonidas, but was the daughter of Leonidas's half-brother. So in other words, her uncle or her half-uncle. So that's an example of dynastic marriage right at the top. But Gorgo appears in Herodotus, very interestingly, as a very smart lady. She, for example, works out, there's a message which is conveyed on a wooden tablet with wax covering over it, typical wax tablet folding. And they open up the tablet, the messenger says, and there's nothing on the wax. What's this? And it's Gorgo who says, scrape the wax off and you'll find the message written on the wood. And so the point is that she's presented as a very smart lady. And then one of her descendants, actually on the other side, there are two Spartan royal families. And until very much later, they never intermarried. So they're quite separate family lives. But a later Spartan princess, a woman called Kyniska, she raised racehorses. She had stables and paid for them to be groomed, the horses, and ridden. And she entered a four-horse chariot at the Olympic Games of 396 and won. So she became the first woman Olympic victor in all of Greek history, the first one in nearly 400 years.
Yeah, so obviously this is another point that where Sparta is remarkable when it comes to greater Greek society as well.
Absolutely.
And, well, I guess one big point on the remarkable nature of Sparta definitely comes down to their political institutions. Obviously, they're quite famous for their dual monarchy and then the Gerousia that goes along with that. How were these institutions, I guess, were they fundamental to Spartan stability?
Again, Herodotus is our principal written narrative source, so he gives it a context. He names names. We do have some evidence that is non-Herodotian. We have some inscriptions and we have some other sources, Plutarch in particular. And the name that Herodotus gives us, and presumably it's the one he was told by the Spartans themselves, is that of Lycurgus. His name means wolf worker, and the lyc bit, the first syllable, lines him up with Apollo, because Apollo, in one of his dimensions, was thought to be wolf-like and also to be a protection against wolves. So if you're in a society with lots of sheep, goats, and you want to protect them from wolves, you appeal to Apollo. So Lycurgus, the wolf worker, was thought to be the guy who devised the entirety of the historical Spartan, we call it constitution, they would have called it set of laws. And those laws affected military matters, economic matters, religious matters, social matters. So he was a sort of total legislator. And the assumption is that he was so brilliant, and he lived quite a long time ago. They couldn't agree exactly how long ago he lived, before the 5th century BC. And they couldn't quite agree to whom he was related. So all this suggests to us historians there may have been such a person, but he didn't do everything he was said to have done. So what we're talking about is an evolved system rather than one created just flashbang wallop like the American Constitution in 1776. And so the key thing for Lycurgus, or the Lycurgan constitution, was to enshrine a balance. And all Greeks, ideally, as a political ideal, put forward the notion of being of one mind, homonoia, having a single resolution about what they should do in any particular situation. So on the one hand, you have elites of birth, and in particular the royal families at the top. And you mentioned the Gerousia, literally old men's council. So the Latin would be senate, same word. You had to be over 60, and almost certainly you had to belong to one of those elite families allegedly descended from Heracles. You're elected, though, by the masses. So this is the compromise. The elite council is elected, but they're elected for life. They're non-responsible. You know, you can't sort of accuse them, but they are the Supreme Court. They have terrific power. What then represented the ordinary Spartan soldier on a daily basis, as it were, was the office of the ephorate. Ephorate means overseers, supervisors. And there were five of them. And they were elected every year. You could only hold the office once. And so elected again, probably by the same sort of means as the Gerousia, by shouting. So candidates are presented before the assembly, and then shouts are given for them. And somebody, and this is where I'm a little bit of chicanery surely came in. A small group decides which was the loudest shout. At any rate, the Air Force were the day-to-day executive of the Spartan state. So you've got this balance, this compromise. Elites, a permanent two-kingship system, a supreme council, which is above and beyond the everyday reach, because they're in office for life. They're like the American Supreme Court in that respect. And so they represent what later Greeks called oligarchy, rule of the few. On the other hand, it's the masses, the majority, who decide by shouting any particular decision. So are we going to go to war? Yes or no. Are we going to pass this measure, this law? Yes or no, and so on. So looking from the outside, you could say, yes, on the one hand, it's a kingship. On the other hand, it's an oligarchy. And yet there's elements of democracy as well. And in the classical period, Aristotle, the greatest political theorist of the ancient Greek world, he couldn't decide exactly what Sparta was. And there's a good reason for that, because Sparta evolved. It didn't come into being and it didn't fit into any particular classical pattern. So there was no revolution of a political kind in the historical fifth or fourth centuries, whereas the other Greek cities, many of them, had many revolutions and different constitutions, which you could identify as democratic or oligarchic. So Sparta's in that sense also, we've mentioned a number of features, if not unique, certainly very distinctive and different.
Yes, it's. I think that's what surprises a lot of people when you talk about the Spartan kingship. They weren't kings that had final say and made all the decisions. There was a complex system behind the whole thing.
And the fact there were two of them, this is something similar to the Roman two consuls. Why were the two consuls? Well, the consuls were thought to have inherited the power of, once upon a time, one king. And so the division is part of the point. They are supreme executives, but they can counter each other, or they can even cancel each other out. And of course, that can lead to divisions within the Gerousia. You've got this king's men and that king's men, and then you've got people who are neither king's men. So there's all sorts of scope for division, and yet there's the overall constraint, helots. We can't afford to be too divided or divisive. We certainly can't afford an internal revolution as long as we're surrounded by and life is based upon a bunch of people, many of whom actually would like to see us off. You know, they'd like to get rid of the Spartans' control of
them. Okay, well, I mean, we're probably getting close to the end of our time here, so I just had a couple more questions, if that's fine with you.
Oh, far away.
Okay. So I guess we want to put in, a bit of a bookmark to the Spartans, because no civilization or society lasts forever. And the power and influence of Sparta would decline over time. What were some of the key factors that led to its decline? And
yes, if you're a military state, ultimately, so that your power is partly symbolic. In other words, you deter others or you get the respect of others because of your reputation. If that reputation is dented in any way, if your enemies start to think you're not what you were, that's the beginning of trouble. So there was a major bust up between Athens and Sparta and its allies. After the Persian Wars, we've been talking about Thermopylae, Herodotus, we get to the so-called Athenopeloponnesian War of the last third of the 5th century, for which Thucydides is the principal source, Thucydides being an Athenian intellectual historian. Spartans won after 27 years over Athens, but only because they were able to get, there's an irony here, money from Persia, because Persia was much more frightened of Athens than it was of Sparta. So they supported Athens's main enemy, Sparta, and Sparta indeed won the Peloponnesian War. But that, in retrospect, was the high point of Sparta's power ever, because thereafter it's a downward slope. And one of the major points in the decline or the degeneration of Spartan power comes in 371 BC. Historian is Xenophon. I mentioned him, pro-Spartan, but writing an account of a major conflict between Sparta and Thebes. Thebes, the rising power, Sparta, the declining power. And near Thebes, in central Greece, a place called Leuctra, the Thebans won hands down. They smashed the Spartan hoplite army. And it turns out by then, the majority of so-called Spartans are actually not Spartan citizens, they're perioikoi, these people who live round about Sparta. Secondly, there are only about 1,500 Spartan citizens, whereas go back to Plataea, there had been 8,000. So there's a decline from 8,000 to 1,000. Something's going on. It's rather complicated. And of those at that battle, 400 out of the 700 who fought at Leuctra died. More than half of the ones fighting died. About a quarter of the entire adult male population of Sparta was killed in one battle. Anyway, after that, it's all over. Their alliance, it's called Peloponnesian League Alliance, breaks up in the 360s. Thebes is number one. And then it's not Sparta that recovers, but Athens recovers better than they had done in the 5th century. And Macedon comes down and beats all of them, beats Athens, beats Thebes. Sparta becomes a bit player by the 320s. Sparta does not become formally a subject of Macedon. It never joins the alliance. Alexander the Great goes off, conquers the Middle East. Macedon is the big player, and it rules mainland Greece, it rules Asia Minor, it rules Egypt, that rules Syria. So these are all Macedonian dynasties. Sparta recovers only after the Roman conquest of all mainland Greece and the Middle East, when through personal connections between the ruling imperial family in Rome, this is Augustus, and his wife, Livia, they have a personal relationship with Sparta. It's quite complicated. Anyway, it means that the Romans give lots of money to the Spartans, and Sparta becomes really quite wealthy and prosperous within the Roman Empire. And part of its revival is a sort of fake theme park revival of ancient Sparta. So it's not really functional because there's no military power allowed by the Romans to the Greeks in mainland Greece. But they, as it were, go through the education, they go through various religious rituals as if they were still living in the 7th or 6th or 5th century BC. But that really is it. And there is, of course, continuous habitation in Sparta until the medieval period when people decide they for safety, because there are lots of people wandering around. We're in the 7th, 8th, 9th centuries. They take off to live in the mountains round about Sparta. And then in the 13th century, in come the Franks, Crusaders, and they build a new town, a place called Mystra, which is about 5 miles from Sparta. And that becomes, as it were, Sparta in the Middle Ages. There are hardly anybody actually living in Sparta. Sparta's pretty much a thing of the past until the early 19th century. As I say, the Greeks rise up against the Ottoman Empire successfully. They become semi-independent in the 1830s. Sparta is rebuilt in 1834.
And I guess after that fall and these sort of revivals, that's where you can maybe people are latching on to this Spartan mirage even in those times as well. And
it goes right through Byzantine.
Helping reinforce those ideas that come all the way to us. And I guess
Absolutely. That
leads on to the legacy and influence that Sparta would leave behind. So in our times, how's Sparta come to influence, say, our military and political thoughts?
Well, I trace the modern world typically in all sorts of respects, political, economic, to the late 18th century. So the French Revolution, American Revolution. And in that period, the divide was, are you for Athens or are you for Sparta? In other words, would you like more to be like your image of Sparta, or would you like to live in a society more like Athens was? And so in the French Revolution context, Voltaire goes for Athens because it's trade, it's culture, high culture, theatre, philosophy, literature. Rousseau, equally brilliant literateur, but he liked the Spartan values of solidarity and suppression of individualism in favor of collective virtue. So he went for Sparta. In the 19th century, it takes a slight, that Athens-Sparta divide is reproduced, but in different terms, in terms of imperialism. So you get the rise of Germany under Prussia. And the Prussians are the military guys, the Junkers, the sort of tough in East, what we now would say was Eastern Germany, of course, Berlin. And they went for Sparta. And against them, the Brits, British Empire, we tended to think we were the descendants of the Athenians. So that continues into the 20th century and takes an exceptionally unpleasant, vicious turn, which is that Hitler, the Nazi ideology, in various ways, from education, child rearing, marital relations, and the notion of a master race and inferiors who should be, if not exterminated, suppressed. All that mapped onto, or was mapped onto, a vision of ancient Sparta. And the reputation of Sparta, really, in Western liberal democratic terms, has never recovered from that appropriation or misappropriation by Hitler's Nazis. On the other hand, the film 300 plays to a certain sort of masculinist narrative of derring do, you know, heroic deeds in extreme circumstances. So the sort of mythology or ideology that might inform, for example, the Americans fighting in Vietnam. And that type of pro-Spartan mirage image is now perpetuated, not so much in Australia, not so much in England, where I'm from, but in North America, by people who are very, very keen on gun rights, typically people from the South, typically very conservative, sometimes white supremacists, and they see the Spartans as their sort of heroic ideological ancestors against blacks or Hispanics or anything they really don't like. And they big up the notion that when Leonidas said, allegedly said to Xerxes, come and get them, Molo and Labi, that is now a slogan of many gun clubs in America to support the notion of, we are arms bearing, we are by law entitled to bear arms, and the state is, as it were, Xerxes, coming to try to take our arms away from us. We're going to resist. So Spartan memories are constantly being revived in, I think, rather unpleasant or very unpleasant ways, rather than focusing on elements of communal solidarity and relatively high status of women. There are various aspects of ancient Sparta that I think could be promoted in a better way than the ones that typically are fastened upon by less desirable elements in our own, or in, at any rate, Western societies today.
Yeah, and what you speak about there is, I find, highly frustrating too, because again, people are playing to that Spartan mirage and picking and choosing certain elements and glorifying it, perhaps in a way that is somewhat distorted from what it was like in ancient Sparta itself. But then people that don't have much of an understanding of Sparta now start to hate ancient Sparta. And it's, I guess, people like yourself, especially your book, The Spartans, I think does an excellent job at giving you a good overview of how Spartan society came about, how it operated, and its core values. I guess sort of much of a bit more detailed than like what we've done today, where we've tried to highlight some of the aspects that have made these people remarkable and on their own terms, though, without trying to insert our own ideas of modern times into it.
Thank you very much. I agree with what you've just said. It's terribly difficult not to insert our values. So that happens in two ways. One is you judge past societies anachronistically. And the other thing is you are so influenced by your contemporary situation that you interpret things in the past that were actually different, as if they were, or you could simply lift them and put them in 2023, take them out of the 50s. You can't. So thank you very much for inviting me. I really enjoyed our talk.
Yeah, so I greatly appreciate you agreeing to come on and have a talk to us. So like I said, I've been a big fan of your work for many years. So once again, thank you, Professor Carlidge, for coming on to talk to us today.
Thank you, Mark Selleck. We'll, I hope, keep in touch, and all best wishes to your listeners. Thank you.
No worries. Thank you. I think we've got, I would love to pick your brain about many other things as well. Cheers.
Well, maybe we'll have another personal chat sometime. Yeah.
All right. Thank you.
All best for now.
I hope everyone enjoyed the interview with Professor Carlidge as much as I enjoyed talking with him. As I have said, I have been a long admirer of his work, and there is always something special about being able to talk with people who have had an impact on your understanding of the world. I trust that the past hour and a half has helped put into perspective the Spartans as a city, people, and society, or in other words, as a polis. Even though our talk did go longer than was originally planned, I felt there was so much more we could have discussed, though I think we were able to effectively cover the main points to help understand what made Sparta remarkable. For those of you who are interested in reading some of Professor Cartlidge's works, I will place up his author page found on Amazon on the episode page and in the show notes, since he has been involved in authoring a great many works. Though I will place some direct links to what I think are some excellent choices when starting on your journey into understanding the Spartans. Next fortnight, we will head back to our regular series, where we'll be following the remainder of the events taking place during the third year of the Peloponnesian War. This will see us turn to Athens, launching a fresh campaign in the Chalcidides, while the Peloponnesian activities in the west will see the Athenians respond with a campaign launched by the general Phormio, and bring the Athenians some much-needed success. Thank you everyone for your continued support, and a big shout-out to all those who have found some value in the series and have been supporting it on Patreon and other various ways. Your contribution is truly helping me grow the series. If you've also found some value in the show and wish to support the series, you can head to www.castingthroughancientgreece.com and click on the Support the Series button, where you can discover many ways to extend your support to helping the series grow. Be sure to stay connected and updated on what's happening in the series, and join me over on Facebook or Instagram at Casting Through Ancient Greece, or on Twitter at Casting Greece. And be sure to subscribe to the series over at the Casting Through Ancient Greece website. I hope you can join me next time when we continue the narrative in the series with episode 79, The Victories of Phormio.